as Imam Khomeini called them, pseudo-saints.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, this is a very key word, isn't it, in our discussion now, isn't it? Yes. The pseudo-saints, yes.
You know, there's no value. It's very egoistic to not look around in your life and look at the problems that the Muslims have, whether it's in your own city, whether it's in the Ummah.
Sure.
And not to do anything about it.
Exactly.
Or to try to do some small little charity action and think like, well, I've done my duty.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. Some people don't have the capacity to do anything more. That's fine.
True.
That's fine. True. We're not asking everybody to be, you know, like Imam.
No.
But I think most Muslims underestimate their own capacity and their own power and their ability to... And when I mean power, I don't mean power independent of Allah. I'm talking about this issue that we talked about before, which is the promise of Allah, which is that if you take a step, if you make effort, if you change your state, Allah will change your state.
Exactly.
If you change your own state, if you go on this path of helping Allah, Allah will help you.
Yes.
And they underestimate the power of this.
Yeah.
And yet, here's a man like Imam.
Who lived that.
Who lived that. Who? And from day one, even before the activities were very political and overt, even before that, in the Hausa, you had people who didn't like him.
Exactly. Or disagreed with his...
Well, not only disagreed. I mean, disagreed is normal.
Normal,
this is,
that's true.
A normal thing that happens among scholars.
Yeah, my disagreement was in much stronger terms. That
right.
They really didn't like the way he was thinking or what he was...
Well, they didn't like the fact that he was talking about implementing Islam.
Ah, thank you.
For them, they were in their safe little zone.
Zones, yes.
Let's just talk about it. Let's have our own little family situation where, you know...
With our tribe and village or...
Or our own household.
Household, yes.
Right? You know, that within the walls, that's it.
That's
outside
it.
The walls, I have nothing to do with it.
With it, yes.
Otherwise, I'll be thrown into jail or otherwise they will, you know, come do something to my son. Or my family.
Sure.
And yet Imam was not like that.
No.
For him, it was about implementing Islam.
Islam. And he really implemented it.
It's about action. Mm. It's not about talking about it.
Sure.
Only. And unfortunately, what ended up happening is instead of those scholars understanding the breadth and the vastness of Islam, they reduced it to very personal ritualistic things.
Yes.
And said, we are implementing Islam.
Yes.
And putting aside all the social aspects of Islam, which, you know, as Imam says, you know, 90% of Islam is social. It's only 10% that relates to personal ritual things. When he talks about this in his book, he talks about that, you know, if you look at the sources, the ayat and the ravayat, he says it's 100 to 1 or you know, some vast ratio in favor of social matters as opposed to personal matters.
Exactly.
And yet we ended up in a situation where...
Where only personal matters are given the greater focus.
And those people were considered saints. And they were really pseudo-saints. Because they were missing the main point.
Of course they were.
Again, we're not saying that people shouldn't do the personal things. We're not saying people shouldn't
No,
pray.
No. But it has to be put in its correct context. It has to be in its correct perspective.
There's this famous... there's a famous tape. Because, you know, before the revolution, he spoke, and this was called the revolution of the cassette. Right?
Yes.
And he would do the tapes. And he's speaking, and, you know, he was very authoritative.
He was already authoritative, even though he was very mild in terms of his manner.
He didn't yell. He didn't. He was very soft-spoken, but he was very authoritative.
Authoritative.
And you know, because he used to do akhlaq, ethics. He used to teach ethics, tazkiyah nafs.
Yes.
You know, soul self-purification.
Absolutely, he was renowned for
that.
There's
a famous tape where he's animated. He's you can tell he's upset. He's like, you know, my people are being killed, and they're telling me to give akhlaq dars. That was for self-purification. He goes, they're killing my... And he repeats it.
They're killing my people.
They're killing my people. And they're telling me I have to give... How can I give you know, ethics class when my people are being killed?
Killed.
So this is the point.
Yes.
You can't give, you know, classes on ethics while your people are being killed.
Killed.
Do something about that, and then also give your ethics class.
Exactly. That's what needs to be dealt
right?
with first.
It's not
because
about...
he's talking in the context, of course, when the Shah's repression was getting was reaching its heights in Iran in terms of curfews and, you know, the
execution, murders, and torture,
and the very same scholars being thrown off rooftops of the top of Fezziah, for example. So, I mean, come on. I mean, you're quite right, sir. Let's get this into perspective here.
Right. So, just like his Mola, who was loved and hated.
Loved and hated, absolutely.
Right? I mean, hated by who? Hated by the enemies of God.
God.
Mm-hmm. Hated by the munafiqeen.
Yes.
By the hypocrites.
Yes.
Hated by
those pseudo saints that were
right.
existing
hated by
at
those
that time.
Who want to maintain their privilege and, you know, live off Baytul Mal.
Yes.
Who want to, you know, take advantage of Islam and see what Islam can do for them as opposed to what they can do for Islam.
Exactly.
Hated by all those who, you know, grudgingly had to accept the Prophet.
Mm.
But in their hearts, iman never entered their hearts.
No, faith never entered
right?
their
hearts. Who took advantage of the Rahmah of the Prophet. And this is not a mistake of the Prophet. The Prophet is, you know,
Rahmatul Alameen. Of course he was.
He's the manifestation of
he
divine Rahmah.
Mercy of God enough.
There is no other thing that he should have done or can do but
except
to
show mercy.
The Rahmah. Because that's his job in this world.
That was his job. Exactly. Thank you for putting
right?
it that
He's
way.
Not
going to
suddenly be like, well, I know you're going to take advantage of me, so I'm not going to be...
No.
Just like Allah doesn't do that.
No, Allah doesn't do that. No.
Right. We take advantage of his mercy...
All the time.
All the time.
Yes, I certainly do.
Right.
Yes.
We all do.
With me, it's a full-time job.
Right.
Yes.
And he doesn't stop being merciful.
I can't recall writing anything at the moment.
Right. We can't recall him not being merciful.
Not being merciful, exactly.
Right.
Thank you.
So, this is the Prophet who, you know, when the conquest of Mecca happened, forgave the enemies.
Yes.
And they took advantage of it. Full advantage.
Full
of
advantage.
Okay, so these were the people that hated Imam Ali. Mm. In the same way, you have Imam Khomeini.
May God bless his soul.
Who, in a society which was very corrupt, which was based on fear, which was based on extreme class distinctions.
Yes.
Where you had, you know, super wealthy royalty.
Aristocrats.
And aristocratic level
elite, yeah.
And then you had a vast
peasant,
large
peasant class
and a small, you know, middle class, which basically was just trying to, you know, not get crushed,
yes, basically,
you know, from
side. Yeah, end up being peasants again, yes.
This is a man who dared to stand up
and challenge that
and challenge all of it,
you
know, root from the root,
from
not simply as a matter of just some tactical political matter.
No, from the root.
The whole legitimacy of this, you know, system that had been entrenched for maybe 1,000 years, where you really had this feudal society, this forced secularization and westernization from top in order to, you know, pursue America's interests and Britain's interests in the world and in the region for the, you know, 20th century, whether it was Britain first in the beginning of the 20th century, whether it was America in the second part of the 20th century, their whole secularization and top-down, you know, benevolent dictator approach that they had with the Pahlavi dynasty, and of course it wasn't benevolent, but this is the way they were justifying it. They were saying he's a dictator, but he's benevolent.
Sure.
He's trying to take his society, you know, towards civilization and towards westernization. So you have that. You have the whole feudal system.
Sure.
You have this illiteracy. You have this ignorance among the people.
Sure.
Which is vast. Mm. It's a mass ignorance.
Mm.
And here's a man who stands up to all this. So of course he's going to have enemies.
Of course he's going to have enemies.
He's going to have enemies within his own circles. He's going to have enemies within the scholars. Religious scholars. He's going to have enemies, of course, within the ruling elites.
Well, that's true. Because
he's going to have enemies, you know, in those countries that are supporting these ruling elites.
Sure. I mean, these are like, you know, for example...
He's going to have enemies among intellectuals and professors.
Absolutely.
And people who are so-called educated and so-called...
Pseudo-intellectuals, of course.
Right, who think that by becoming...
Who only want to get their own benefit out of the system.
Yeah, who are saying that, you know, we have to become Western in order to advance.
That's right.
And he's saying, we have to follow Islam to advance.
Of course, because he had an extraordinary insight into... the message of Islam and from the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, was living them, and at the same time, as we've discussed in other programs as well, he's the living embodiment of Islam. I mean, he understands it on a level that, you know, even today, you know, we don't have that, you know, in a sense.
Right. And so we see that just you know, as the example of Hezbollah, you have polarization. Polarization is not a bad thing.
No, it's not.
Having enemies gives you value.
It does.
This is one of the ways you can tell the character of a person.
Person.
In fact, we have the Supreme Leader talking about this in terms of nations, about how nations, you know, who don't have enemies don't really have value.
No, they don't.
How is it possible that you would, you know, not have any enemies? We're not talking about small nations which need to just, you know, we're talking about nations who are, you know, have their own history, their own culture, who are, you know, pillars of human civilization,
sure.
who are not, you know, countries that are on the periphery.
Sure.
I'm not talking about geographically on the periphery. I'm talking about civilizationally.
Sure.
Well, of course you're going to have differences. If you're going to stand up for haq, if you're going to stand up for justice.
Yeah.
Imam Ali, there's the famous story where, you know, he's the Khalifa and his relative, his cousin.
That's right. Yes. Very nice story.
You're
That's
Mr.
Right.
Hadith. So yes, yeah. please go ahead if
sure.
you want to tell us.
No, I mean, I'll leave that entirely to yourself.
Well, basically, just to give you the gist of it, you know, he has his cousin who he likes and who likes him. And there's, you know, there's good relations in terms of friendship, friendly relations.
Sure.
Who wants money
from Bayt al-Mal.
From Bayt al-Mal, from the treasury.
Yes.
And he takes...
He was asking for that extra money, and the Imam refused. He said, no, you can't have that.
And then he took a piece of burning...
Burning stone.
Burning
because
coal.
Coal, and I think, if I remember correctly, he was blind, I believe. He was. And he gave that in his hand, and, you know... I'll let you carry
on. Well, basically, he said, why'd you do this? My hand is... He said, this is just so you that feel the fire.
Fire of hell, exactly.
When you do these things.
When
you ask for this, this is the result of it. Okay? So even with his closest relatives, he maintained justice.
Exactly. Exactly.
So, you know...
In other words, he was saying to him that you're getting your due share from Bayt al-Mal.
Right.
You don't need anything extra.
Right, and not only that, but this is what justice is.
This is what justice is. Yes,
it's not about me being your cousin and your relative.
Exactly, because this was the whole intention of his asking, because he was trying to use that relationship to get something more out of it, and this was exactly the problem that Kufa was facing, because there was so much nepotism, so much of this favoritism, that that money was being expropriated, going to the wrong people. There was a poor class in Kufa, for which Mawla, as we all have read and know from our childhood stories, that he was carrying flour and food to the doors of those people because of this corruption that had set into Kufa. And the Imam wanted to redress that, rebalance that. But unfortunately, we know about the battles and so on and so forth. And what
right. And so
place.
Basically, you see, and even more intense, the whole thing with Talha and Zubayr.
Exactly.
You know,
the companions who were
very close companions. You know, these were people who were there when Hazrat Fatima salam alayha was being buried,
yes.
Which is very rare distinction.
Yes.
In human
and
history.
How that turned, right?
Yeah. So we're not talking about, you know, low level people. We're talking about heavy guys.
Heavy duty stuff.
And yet he's even standing in front of them and saying, "Look, we can't. You know, why are you doing this? Why are you ruining everything for yourself?"
Selves.
Okay? Now, let me just add this here. Exactly like Imam Ali alayhi salam, Imam Khomeini, his enemies acknowledged him as being somebody that is just.
Just.
And somebody who is, you know, capable and stands up for truth. So this is another thing that distinguishes somebody who is polarizing.
That's right. Because when the enemy itself acknowledges the fact that you are right, correct on the principled stand that
you are
what you say you are.
Exactly.
Thank you.
So this is the point. You know, we have this unfortunate disease amongst us ourselves. I'm including myself as the number one
absolutely.
Person with this problem.
Sure.
Is
and
that
the one
we
that
think.
You're talking to as well and discussing this, yes, absolutely.
That we think that somehow, if we stand up for Islam, this is not going to be to our benefit. That somehow we should just, you know, tone it down a little. You know, don't... And when I mean tone it down, I'm not talking about, you know, in terms of expression.
I'm talking
about principle.
Principle, yes.
You know, well, we see that Imam Ali does the exact opposite.
He does the exact
We see
opposite.
That Imam Khomeini does exactly the opposite.
Sure. And this is why we unfortunately read... in history, the loneliness of Imam Ali.
Exactly.
And that is very, very difficult to express, because I can't help being emotional as soon as I say those
words. Of course.
Because this is the price you pay for,
of course,
trying to, for doing the right thing.
Right. Now, Imam Ali in its greatest degree, but if you look at Imam Khomeini as well, you know.
It was very lonely at the
top. Can you imagine, you're 80 years old.
Yes.
And you are responsible for an entire nation, which is going through the deepest social revolution it's gone through in 1,000 years.
Years, absolutely.
You're fighting a war with the whole world
against you.
Okay.
And with sanctions.
And everything that goes with it. You're dealing with munafiq. You're dealing with munafiq who have pulled a sword. You're dealing with people within your own group who are actually agents of the enemies. And yet you handle it. And of course, this has to do with relying on God and believing in truth and standing up for truth. This is the greatest power anyone can have. The way you want power, I'm telling you this.
Yes.
You want power?
Sure.
Stand up for truth.
Exactly.
Allah will give you the power.
Allah will give you the power.
The minute you don't stand up for truth, Allah will be like, hey, you want me to give you power for not standing up for truth? And you know what? This is something we experience in our own lives. Just think about the situations in your own life.
Sure.
Those of us who've had a little bit more time to sin in this world.
Yes, absolutely.
Right?
Yes, true.
Those times when you didn't stand up for haq, Allah gave you the answer.
He did.
He answered you in a way and you realized, oh my God,
I shouldn't have done that.
This is where I went wrong.
This is where I went
wrong. And those times when you stand up for truth, where you stood up for truth,
yes,
and you fought it, and you handled it, and you had the sabr, and you had the patience, and you had the steadfastness, Allah rewarded you immediately.
Immediately. That's true.
Okay.
True.
So we see that you have Imam Ali alayhi salam, who, as Shahid Matari says, is this figure who is this person, is this being who is polarizing, pulls in the good, right? Repels the bad.
The evil, the bad.
And those who are enemies of truth and of God.
Sure.
And exactly the same way, you know, whatever, 1,400 years later,
sure,
you have a person like Imam Khomeini who comes at a time in world history, at a time in Iranian history, at a time in Islamic history, at a time in global history,
sure,
and completely changes the equation.
And I tell you one thing, though, this attraction, this polarization you talk about, and repulsion, is very true of Imam Khomeini, because we who were living outside Iran had nothing to do with what was happening here in the Islamic Republic, were simply found this attraction due to the basis of his righteousness, due to this principled righteous stand that Imam Khomeini was the living embodiment of, was immediately attracted those people who also want to join in that
exactly.
good. And the repulsion, yes, that was for those who basically are on the path of unbelief. So let them go their own way.
Exactly. So, and I think the one lesson we can learn from Imam Ali and from Imam Khomeini,
sure,
and Imam Ali as the main figure in this, and Imam Khomeini as that thing that we saw in our own lives, not just something that we read about.
No. I mean, this is
experience. Whenever you stand up for truth, whenever you stand up for Islam, whenever you stand up for God, even though it's hard in the beginning, Allah will reward you.
Exactly.
And whenever, and exactly the opposite happens. So don't think this is just one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is also true, which is that when you don't stand up for truth, when you compromise unnecessarily on certain matters, of principle, when you think that you are doing, you know, something with the enemies of truth because it will somehow, you know, help you personally, or it will somehow, you know, allow you to move on, then Allah punishes you in ways that you couldn't even have imagined.
Sure.
So let's not make that mistake.
Mm-hmm.
And let's look at the example that we had with Imam in our lives and use that as the example in our daily lives.
Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, thank you very much for that insight, and I'm sure we're going to have much more deeper discussions exactly about this polarization in later sessions. But thank you very much indeed for your contribution today, and I hope listeners have benefited from the program. And it just leaves me to say, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all. Thank you very much for listening today, and goodbye.
wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On Friday, Israel declared it has placed six prominent Palestinian human rights groups on the regime's so-called terrorist list. The targeted groups include key partners of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. The six targeted human rights groups are Ad-Damir, Al-Haq, Defense for Children Palestine, the Union of Agricultural Work Committees, Bisson Center for Research and Development, and the Union of Palestinian Women Committees. Some of these rights groups have closely cooperated with the International Criminal Court in its probe into Israeli war crimes in the occupied West Bank and Gaza. According to Palestinian media, the move will pave the way for Israel to effectively outlaw the activities of these civil society groups, raid their offices, seize their assets, arrest and jail their staff members, and even criminalize any public expressions of support for these groups. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv has justified the blacklisting by accusing the right groups of having ties with the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine resistance movement, alleging they have provided funding for anti-Israeli resistance groups. Israel's move to designate Palestinian NGOs as terrorist organizations is yet another example of its decades-long crackdown on political activism in the occupied territories. The move has sparked condemnations from inside and outside the occupied territories. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shtayyeh stated that the Palestinian organizations work with international institutions, and thus their blacklisting is a serious violation of international law. Shtayyeh called on world bodies to denounce the designations and prevent their implementation. Also, the spokesman for the Hamas resistance movement blasted the Israeli move as terrorist behavior. Hazem Qasem said, "The move disregards international law and wages a war on Palestinian existence." Palestinian human rights organization Al-Haq joined the chorus of condemnation as well.
First, this is clearly a political decision and the continuation of an Israeli campaign that has been taking place for more than a decade, targeting Palestinian organizations with the aim of silencing and frightening them in order to stop them from playing their primary role in defending Palestinians' rights.
Jabarin also urged the countries which support Palestine to adopt a clearer position and take serious and a strong action on the issue. Three U.S. Democratic lawmakers also condemned Israel's decision as an attempt to silence advocates of Palestinian rights and called for its withdrawal. In addition, international rights groups condemned the move as an assault on civil society and expressed solidarity with the targeted organizations.
This is a very provocative escalation, but it is, I wouldn't say it's a new war because the war has been ongoing for years now, but it's clearly an attempt to defame, defund, and delegitimize some very, very important human rights organizations that do incredible work in Israel. I happen to have personally worked with all six, which says something, I guess.
Washington has played a key role in shielding Israel despite its blatant crimes for decades, giving it a sort of impunity to get away without any persecution. This has been done through the supply of arms, financial support, and UN vetoes that has given Israel the audacity to time and again attempt to defame and sabotage the work of Palestinian human rights groups to end its impunity. The regime's latest move to blacklist six Palestinian human rights groups is yet another example of Israel's systematic and relentless campaign against Palestinian civil society organizations and leading human rights defenders. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem has described Tel Aviv's declaration as characteristic of totalitarian regimes with the clear purpose of shutting down these organizations. In fact, this move threatens to shut down civil society groups that document human rights violations by Israel. They report human rights abuses against Palestinian children, advocate rights of the thousands of Palestinians held as political prisoners by Israel, and so forth.
Well, I think the Israeli government has long attempted to crush any information about their violations, about, you know, for instance, to the international courts, about all sorts of violations of international law, and that this is a continuation of their policy of suppressing criticism of the occupation and the siege of Gaza.
Human rights defenders are not terrorists and should never be accused like this. Clearly, Israel intends to silence the violations that it is committing in the occupied territories by attacking the civil society organizations. Therefore, if not responded to swiftly and properly, this could give the green light to Tel Aviv that it can shamelessly continue its crimes against Palestinians.
The United States and China have in recent months escalated their war of words. This time, China says its sovereignty is at risk, cautioning the U.S. against sending the wrong signals.
We urge the U.S. to strictly abide by the One China principle and the three joint communiques. The U.S. should act and speak cautiously on the Taiwan issue and refrain from sending wrong signals to separatist forces in Taiwan to avoid seriously damaging Sino-U.S. relations and peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman warned that his country has no room for compromise on issues involving its core interests, including its territorial integrity. Wang also noted that Taipei is an inalienable part of China's territory, and the issue is purely China's internal affair, and that Beijing won't allow any external interference. He was responding to these comments U.S. President Joe Biden made during a CNN town hall Q&A.
I don't want a cold war with China. I just want to make China understand that we are not going to step back. We are not going to change any of our views.
So are you saying that that the United States would come to Taiwan's defense if China attacked?
Yes, we have a commitment.
What the United States says, if the American president puts in the minds of China, of the Taiwanese independence activists and independence politicians, the idea that Taiwan could, for example, make a declaration of independence, China would act on that. And I don't know what the United States could, or on its own, on the terms of its own terms of China policy since the last 50 years, should do or could do to prevent China from acting on that.
The U.S. has recently deployed a fleet of B-1 bombers and 200 airmen to its notorious base at Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, the first such deployment to the island in 15 years. The base at Diego Garcia has a dark history. The U.S. has used the base to launch airstrikes in Iraq and Afghanistan, and it's said to have been used as a black site to interrogate and torture victims of the CIA. China considers Taiwan as part of its territory and has warned against any of its independence bids. Tensions escalated recently over Chinese military flights as well as increased U.S. military support for Taiwan. Just 2 weeks ago, U.S. media reported that American forces had been secretly training Taiwanese troops for months. China has sovereignty over Chinese Taipei, and under the One China policy, almost all world countries recognize that sovereignty. The U.S., too, recognizes Chinese sovereignty over the island, but has long curtailed Taipei in an attempt to unnerve Beijing. The United States, which backs Taipei's separatist president, also continues to sell weapons to the island in defiance of Beijing and in violation of its own official policy.
There's what they call a strategic ambiguity in American policy. They like to keep Taiwan as in some kind of de facto independent status, but they have recognized de jure that it's one country and Taiwan is a part of China.
China has also denounced the recently clinched AUKUS pact between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the US, under which the trio is expected to make a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. Beijing argues that the pact threatens regional stability and poses nuclear proliferation risks. US President Joe Biden has repeatedly vowed to re-engage with the international community, marking a departure from his predecessor Donald Trump's foreign policy. In case of China, however, it appears that he's following the footsteps of Donald Trump's America First stance against Beijing.
Abdulbari Atwan, a well-known author, has described the recent highlights in Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon as an American Zionist conspiracy to ignite a civil war in the region. Atwan stated that the U.S. Zionist conspiracy to create a sectarian conflict in the region will fail. He said, sectarian conflicts have been created with the aim of securing Israel's interests and stealing Lebanese gas. But this sedition will not go ahead, and if it goes on, the U.S. and its allies will surely be defeated. In fact, the axis of resistance in the region has so far managed to oppose Western, namely United States and Israel, interests in the region and foiled their plots. Members of the axis of resistance include Iran, Syria, and Lebanon's Hezbollah, and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, to name a few. The U.S. has attempted to weaken the resistance axis by hatching different plots, such as causing instability and wars in the region for years. However, the resistance has always been ready to properly respond to these threats. For instance, Washington has always sought to keep Israel's enemies at one another's throat so that they could not give Israel trouble. But the resistance front has time and again proven that it will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity, as it has launched retaliatory attacks against Tel Aviv, which have exposed the vulnerability of the regime's entities in the region. Israel's constant violations of Lebanese airspace are also a source of instability. This has been seen as a constant provocation by Israel, mainly directed at the resistance movement Hezbollah. Meanwhile, the U.S. has also been accused of creating an atmosphere of instability. On the one hand, it has imposed sanctions on Lebanon, which prevents foreign investment in the country. It has even opposed the delivery of fuel shipments from Iran, is in an emergency mode due to a lack of fuel. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador has stirred controversy by making anti-Hezbollah statements, so much so that a judge ordered a media ban on her. The trip by the number three diplomat at the State Department, Victoria Nolan, to Lebanon, also proved to be controversial. Her purpose was to meet government officials and representatives to discuss Lebanon's reforms and elections. The question that arises is, what does she have to do with Lebanon's elections? Nolan was famously accused of promoting regime change in Ukraine, backing the Maidan protesters and opposition, which showed how the Ukrainian opposition is being manipulated by Washington. Coincidentally, while she was there, the deadly protest in Lebanon erupted, which resulted in the death of several Lebanese. What is for certain is that the popularity of the resistance in the region will be a severe challenge for the enemies, who are hatching plots against them, specifically Israel and the U.S. The face-off between the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro and the opposition led by Juan Guaido has put Caracas in a years-long political impasse and economic crisis. Several rounds of talks in recent years have been futile, and the two sides have failed to reach a consensus. In August, the Venezuelan government and the opposition began a new round of negotiations in Mexico City aimed at overcoming Venezuela's political and economic crisis. The dialogue was mediated by Norway. However, the latest developments have hampered the process of a possible settlement. Venezuela's government has decided to suspend the talks after Cape Verde extradited a Venezuelan envoy named Alex Saab to the United States on money laundering charges on Saturday. Saab was arrested in Cape Verde under a U.S. arrest warrant in June 2020 when his plane stopped there to refuel. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro lashed out at the U.S. for what he called kidnapping of an envoy to face an American court.
Saab was taken yesterday, skirting over everything. A plane arrived, assassins, hitmen came down. They sought him out and they removed him with blows from the jail he was held. They took him without advising lawyers, the family, nobody. A kidnapping by the United States government of an international diplomat.
Jorge Rodriguez, who heads the government's negotiating team, described the government's decision as a deep expression of protest over the brutal aggression against Alex Saab. He also called on Washington to release Saab immediately.
Venezuela is alerting the world that the life of Alex Saab is in danger. It's in the hands of judicial system that is directed at harming Venezuela. And we demand his immediate release by the American government.
The U.S. charged Saab in 2019 in connection with a bribery scheme and sanctioned him for allegedly orchestrating a corruption network that allowed Caracas to profit from a state-run food subsidy program. However, Saab's lawyers have denied the U.S. charges as politically motivated.
This is absolutely a political attack on Venezuela, and it is a kidnapping. This shows just how far in lawlessness the United States is willing to go and how much they are determined to attack Venezuela.
Meanwhile, U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido reacted to the decision to suspend the talks, accusing the government of evading the nation's problems. Caracas aims to ease U.S.-led sanctions on the Venezuelan nation, while the opposition says it aims to use the talks to secure guarantees for regional elections to be held in the fall. Venezuela descended into political turmoil after U.S.-backed opposition figure Juan Guaido unilaterally declared himself as the interim president in January 2019. He claimed that Maduro's re-election in 2018 was fraudulent. Then, United States refrained from recognizing Nicolas Maduro's re-election in 2018, imposed sanctions on the crisis-hit economy of the Latin American nation, and froze millions of dollars of Venezuelan money in the U.S. bank account. Washington has been using sanctions as leverage to overthrow the legitimate government of Maduro in what has been termed economic terrorism. Venezuela has faced chronic shortages of food and medicine as a result of U.S. sanctions, resulting in years of political and economic crisis.
Well, this is exactly what the U.S. government wants to prevent. And this may be also an effort on their part to sabotage even the negotiations going on in Mexico. That how can the talks continue under in this situation? But What needs to be condemned and denounced is depriving any country of food and medicine, particularly in this time of pandemic.
While freezing assets and slapping illegal sanctions on countries that refuse to submit to Washington's hegemonic policies is nothing new, the U.S. sanctions have directly targeted Venezuelan people. Experts say the sanctions, used as a tool for regime change, have no effect on the stability of Maduro administration, but further complicate the socioeconomic condition of ordinary people amidst a full-blown crisis.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, The Hague and the Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law. The distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. We now present you an article written jointly by Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta. The piece is titled U.S. Drone Strikes, Errors, and the Cost in Human Life. The article has been published by the Asia Times. Please stay with us for more of Alfred de Zayas and Adriel Casunta's article. According to the initial reporting from U.S. officials, the 29th of August drone strike aimed at annihilating members of the terrorist group Daesh was described as a successful operation that destroyed a car filled with multiple suicide bombers, posing an imminent threat to U.S. occupation troops leaving Afghanistan after the Taliban takeover. The celebratory mood did not last long, though, as witness reports that emerged shortly after the incident in Kabul's Khawaja Burga neighborhood debunked the Pentagon's narrative by exposing the ugly truth. The casualties were not terrorist savages, but 10 innocent members of the Ahmadi family, including 7 children. After photographs showing victims right before their deaths had emerged and actual footage of their horror began circulating on social media, it became clear that the youngest victims were just 2 years old. Another one killed in the airstrike was a 36-year-old former Afghan serviceman, an employee of the charity organization Nutrition and Education International, identified as Zamarai Ahmadi. Although, because of the public pressure, the Pentagon was later forced to admit that the assassination of these civilians was a tragic mistake, and ex gratia condolence payments to the Ahmadi family have been raised during a recent online meeting between Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Colleen Carl and the founder and president of Nutrition and Education International, Dr. Stephen Wan. The accountability for similar actions remains the great unknown. According to Amal Ahmadi's 22-year-old nephew, Farshad Haydari, as of 18th of September, the United States had made no direct contact with the family of the victims. Farshad Haydari told Agence France-Presse news agency they must come here and apologize to us face to face. Furthermore, despite U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin's recent assertions that the Pentagon will endeavor to learn from this horrible mistake, there is little hope that this is the case, bearing in mind that the similar incidents concerning killing large numbers of civilians in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria had already taken place in the past. According to numerous reports by the New York Times and the Reuters news agency and other media. As Nick McDonnell, author of a 2018 book titled The Bodies in Person, An Account of Civilian Casualties in American Wars, argues, in fact, the U.S. military has repeatedly suppressed information on civilian casualties. Nick McDonnell says the drone program is opaque, with extremely limited accountability for anyone involved. Bearing in mind that most of the U.S. drone strikes in Afghanistan have taken place in rural areas, and the fact that there is a direct correlation between the intensity of airstrikes and the cries in the investigation of civilian deaths in their result, there is little hope for meaningful justice for the victims, apart from this isolated case. Public outrage depends on the attention that the mainstream media will pay to drone killings. From the perspective of international humanitarian law, the Hague and Geneva Conventions, it is clear that drones are indiscriminate weapons and therefore illegal because they contravene the two core rules of international humanitarian law. The distinction between military and civilian targets and the principle of proportionality. Moreover, they entail serious violations of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which the United States and all NATO countries are bound to observe. It is worth noting that the concluding observations of the United Nations Human Rights Committee following the examination of the U.S. Fourth Period Report in 2014 condemned targeted killings using unmanned aerial vehicles or drones as contrary to Article 6 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR. We can read in the document, the committee is concerned about the lack of transparency regarding the criteria for drone strikes, including the legal justification for specific attacks, and the lack of accountability for the loss of life resulting from such attacks. The document said, the committee remains concerned about the state party's very broad approach to the definition and geographical scope of armed conflict, including the end of hostilities, the unclear interpretation of what constitutes an imminent threat, who is a combatant or a civil or a civilian taking direct part in the hostilities, the unclear position on the nexus that should exist between any particular use of lethal force and any specific theater of hostilities, as well as the precautionary measures taken to avoid civilian casualties in practice. Similarly, in his 2010 report to the Human Rights Council, Professor Philip Alston denounced indiscriminate killings through drones and concluded that the rationale given for their use eviscerate the human rights law prohibition against the arbitrary deprivation of life. In addition, drone killing of anyone other than the target, family members or others in the vicinity, for example, would be an arbitrary deprivation of life under human rights law, and could result in state responsibility and individual criminal liability. 2014, Ben Emmerson, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Counterterrorism, issued a damning report condemning the accountability vacuum for civilian killings by drones. As a United Nations independent expert on international order, one of the authors of this article agreed with Philip Alston and Ben Emmerson and decried the institutional impunity of the United States and North Atlantic Treaty Organization NATO, insisting that there is state responsibility, both civilian and penal, and an obligation by those states causing collateral damage to make reparations to the victims and their families. Unfortunately, although empirical evidence demonstrates the incompatibility of the use of drones with international law, the United States will continue ignoring the Human Rights Committee and the Special Rapporteur of the Human Rights Council because they lack enforcement mechanisms. It seems that drones will continue to be used with impunity until the international community agrees to exercise universal jurisdiction over war criminals, arrest them when they enter their jurisdiction, and thus vindicate the rights of the victims of such savagery. Above all else, the question remains, what is the right amount of money that can make up for the loss of innocent life? The mainstream media would be well advised to cease whitewashing these crimes, playing down the human cost of drones and disseminating disinformation about a supposed legal black hole. The priority must always be to provide immediate assistance, and not just money, to the victims and ensure that the new prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, and expeditiously investigates these crimes.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, only a name from Islam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. We cannot say whether this interesting prediction has already materialized fully in this present time, or is it yet to happen in future. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, "A day will come for people when only letters and drawings from the Holy Quran and Islam, in name only, will remain among them. Muslims' mosques will be improved in building structure and ruined as regards the guidance they provide." Some may argue that this is what we are witnessing as we speak. There are so many mosques throughout the Islamic lands, and if you go to the West even, you see that there are Islamic centers, there are mosques, there are Imam Bargahs, there are Husseinias, under different titles. But how effective are they? This is a question some people raise. Now, when you look at what Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, we see that this prophecy of Imam Ali alayhi salam is coming to fruition. It's the reality, the new reality that we may be facing. Again, there are others who argue that no, our mosques are still effective. The underlying work that is being done, the community service that is being done, the message of guidance that is being sent out from these mosques, it still is very much alive. Again, it is a topic for another day where we
debate and discuss this. But we know that Imam Ali alayhi salam informed us of a time where our masjids will become ineffective and the message of guidance will cease to come out of them. Welcome back, dear listeners. We don't know whether we have reached that time or not, where our mosques have become ineffective in essence in terms of it sending out the message of guidance, but we know that this is something that is bound to happen now or in future. But surely what we are witnessing, some examples of it here and there are prevalent in the society. When we talk about the message of guidance not going out of the mosques and the mosques becoming all grand and all fancy and all filled with facilities, air conditioner, nice rugs, nice carpets, nice building, nice construction, we do see it happening where the effectiveness of these mosques in some cases may be going down. It is surprising that in such cases, the Muslims complain about their backwardness when they themselves have caused it by their mistaken notion that it is sufficient to adopt Muslim names and pay a nominal lip service to Islam, and that Quran is there only for decorative purposes. They have not accepted the Quran's real role as a book of unbeatable value for education, training, and application in day-to-day life. Nor have they accepted Islam as a school that must engage and permeate their practical and intellectual lives. Can you find a real Islamic society which follows Islam in substance, not just in form, which has been backward or has not enjoyed an honorable status in the world? This is a question we raise and leave you with Allah's permission. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.